My name is Sarah Sumner Eisenbrand. I am 37 years old. Today is August 28th, 2018. We are in the San Diego USO office, and I'm here talking to Nick Ferrante, who is a member of my congregation here in St. Andrews. It's called St. Andrews here in San Diego.
And my name is Nicholas Biagio Ferrante. I am 26 years old. Today's date is August the 28th of the year, 2018. We're at the San Diego USO, and I am, I guess she's my pastor, right?
I guess so.
Pastor Sarah is my pastor at St. Andrews Lutheran Church.
Mm-hmm. All right, Nick, where were you born, and where did you grow up?
It's the same answer. I was born, I guess I was born in San Diego, right, in the greater San Diego area. I was born at... Oh, gosh. My mother's going to kill me if I get this wrong, but I'm pretty sure it's the Grossmont Hospital. About 90% sure it's like the sharp one.
Did you almost say Grossmont High School?
High School, yeah. I was born, yeah.
That must be a story. Yeah.
That's a different story. No, my mother and father happily wed out of high school when they had me. No, I was born there, but I grew up in Lakeside, California. Mm-hmm. So that's where I grew up, yeah.
And do you still live in the same house you grew up
in? I do. For the record, at the age of 26, I am happy being home. It's great because I'm in school right now, and I'm certain that's going to come up in the questions at some point.
Is your full name Nick?
My full name is not Nick. My full name is Nicholas, but I go by Nick.
And do you have any other nicknames besides Nick?
You know what? Not really. My grandfather used to call me Nicodemo, and I liked that one a lot. So he was into that. But that aside, Nick is it. My dad calls me Big Boy. That's a thing. I want that to be on tape. So yeah, my dad calls me Big Boy.
Okay. Let's see. So we are going to spend some time talking about your service in the military. Maybe
good.
We should talk about that a little bit. Oh, talk about your time in the military. So you were not drafted. You enlisted.
I did at the young age of 17.
And what made you decide? Or I guess my first question is, how long did you know that you wanted to do that when you graduated high school?
Oh, I hadn't graduated yet, actually, when I enlisted. I enlisted the summer before my senior year. So they had a the reason why I joined the National Guard is because they said, we can take you now. I said, all right, done. Let's do that. So I enlisted at the age of 17. And I knew as long as I can remember. Like, it was always a part of my life. My mother had served. My grandfather had served. My dad's dad. So my mom's stepfather, who I consider my grandfather in my life, Robert Jasek, he had served in the Marine Corps, and he was, you know, oorah, semper fi, do or die, you know, that kind of a devil dog. Mm-hmm. So I grew up with that, and it wasn't a if but when for me, you know?
Okay. And did your family know that?
Yes. They were very aware.
And were they supportive of you enlisting before you graduated?
Extremely, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So how did you do it? I mean, what was the process?
What do you do? So I was in high school, and I had brought it up to my counselor. And my counselor said, hey, you know what? There's a National Guard recruiter that I'm really good friends with. Maybe you should talk to him. I said, okay, sure. So I talked to him, and one of my good friends, Chris. Chris was in the National Guard as well, and he had brought it up to me before. So I thought, you know, why not? Let's check this whole thing out. So I went and talked to him. And it was before I had turned 17, so I guess there's, like, some rules about, like, when you can start talking to people. And then once I was able to talk to him, I talked to him, and the paperwork started the day I turned 17. Like, I was ready to go. On May 20th, I said, let's jump into this. So I turned 17 in May, and I enlisted in July.
But would you have been a junior in high school then?
Yes. So
that point?
So once you're out, you in the National Guard, to date, it still exists today, so it's called the Recruit Sustainment Program. So you actually join, and you're in the National Guard, enlisted, and your time starts ticking. So your service starts at the age of 17, even though you haven't gone to basic training yet. So I did a year of that, mm-hmm. and then went off to basic in June? No. Yeah. June of 2010. Yeah.
And that
so
right
enlisted
after
in 2009, 2010, yeah. So okay. Basically like a week after I graduated, I left.
And what do you remember about the day that you enlisted?
Oh, the day I enlisted. Ah, that was a pain. So that was a big pain. So administratively, I was fine. But medically, I grew up with flat feet, very, very flat feet. And I had surgery to correct them. And that was a paperwork nightmare getting that all blessed off. But I did get it blessed off and I enlisted. And I don't really remember a lot from MEPS because it is a god-awful place.
What do you mean MEPS?
MEPS is the Military Enlistment Processing Station.
Okay.
So that's where you go to join. Okay. And you wait in this room all day and it's not that much fun. which they got to do it somehow, right? And I remember I was walking between like the waiting area and the enlistment area. And I had seen all my family and my friend Chris had come there. And I knew my aunt was supposed to be there. My aunt Heidi.
Yeah.
Heidi Lyon. It was Eastcott at the time. Was it Eastcott? No, she's married. So it was Lyon at that point. And I saw her running across, like in front of the military entrance processing station in San Diego, which is where I enlisted from. Mm-hmm. There's like this huge grass area out in front. And I saw her like running across it, holding her shoes in her hand. And I was like, oh, good, she made it. And then we walked in and yeah, so that was super cool. So she got to be there for my swearing in. So that was cool.
So there's like a ceremony.
Yeah, there's a ceremony. Yeah. So you do your oath. I do solemnly swear to, you know, serve, protect, and defend, or whatever that you end up saying.
You remember it, don't you?
I don't. I've said it twice, and I don't remember it.
But no. You remember some of the other things. Maybe we'll get to that later, that you memorized.
Sure.
Because you've told stories about that. You memorized something, and that when you were...
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
We'll get to that a little
mm-hmm.
bit later.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you choose the National Guard?
So, it was the one that would take me when I was 17, and I could join then. You know, is an impatience thing. They said we can do that. And they had said, you know, in the National Guard, you know, it's not all reserve time, and I made my career not reserve time. I mean, I didn't ever not work in the National Guard. I was always doing something. And they said, you know, you can go to college and we'll pay for your college and you just got to serve 1 weekend a month and 1 weekend a month my butt because, you know, Afghanistan.
Right.
But that'll come. but, yeah. So, and it was really cool, and I got to do some really amazing things. But I chose the National Guard because they're the ones that are going to take me first.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But when you enlisted, you knew that we were still in active, military combat in Afghanistan.
Oh, heck yes.
Yeah. So,
yeah, and Iraq as well at that point.
Iraq, yeah. And so did you know that that was a possibility that
Not only did I know, I was ready. Like, that's why you join, you know? Go make sure that the rest of the world can share the same freedoms that we do.
And so that was a motivation for you, is that you wanted to go across abroad? And
I mean, I don't know where your questions are at, but I mean, this is a good segue for my deployment.
Sure.
When you join, like, it's something that you're ready for. Like, you don't learn how to shoot a rifle just for kicks, you know? And so they were looking for volunteers to go to Afghanistan. So I actually volunteered to deploy. I didn't get deployed. I volunteered
deploy. And how old were you then?
19.
Okay. So you knew that that was a possibility.
And oh, yeah.
You said, no, this is something I want to do.
Yeah.
And so what kind of training did you do to get to that point where you, before you left? I mean, what kind of training? I mean, obviously you went to basic training, but like what kind of role did you have or were you planning on having after you were deployed?
So when we were ramping up for deployment, or when we were ramping up, I guess that'd be the word, yeah. We're getting ready to go. We did a bunch of training. So when you're in the National Guard, it's a different process than when you're active duty. So in the active duty sector, like, they're pretty much ready to go, right? In the National Guard, you have to go through some training to get you ready to go to the pre-mobilization training to get you ready to deploy. So in the California National Guard, we went to this place called Camp Roberts, which is up near Paso Robles, California.
Mm-hmm.
And it is from, like, World War II. And, like, if you could imagine a World War II barracks, that's... It hasn't changed since World War II. It's that.
I've actually seen it.
You've seen Camp Roberts?
Yeah, because I used to live up there.
Yes.
It is. It's like back in time.
It is like stepping back in time. I loved it. So we went up there, right, and we did we were getting ready to do convoy security. Like, that's what we had been told we were going to do because we were military police, so that was my job, I guess. Military police. And we were being requested for gun truck support for the retrograde operation in Afghanistan. So basically they're transporting cargo within Afghanistan, and a lot of it's to pull the cargo out of Afghanistan, right? And that was the transportation company. So I deployed with the 1072nd Transportation, but I had been attached to a couple different transportation companies along the way getting ready to deploy. And we were attached with truckers. So we were to be their gun trucks. So we were a gun truck, for the record, I guess, would be... so you have your vehicle, right, and they have the weapon systems that are mounted on top of it, and then you have your cargo trucks, right, that are carrying cargo. So we were the security...
For the cargo. Okay. And so that was your, that was not a part of basic training. That was the training after basic training?
Actually, because the military police is such a valiant and awesome branch of the Army, we actually get training convoy security. That's one of the five staples of being a military policeman. That's one of, like I say, five duties, right? One of them is convoy security. For 2 weeks in advanced training, it's not basic, but your advanced training to become a military policeman, you do convoy security. So I had learned it there. And then when you get ready to go, you start getting what's called your SOPs, your standard operating procedures. You start getting those down. You start getting a feel for, like, how this actually works. Mm-hmm. You know, because in training you get a way, right? And then you start building your way, you know? Mm-hmm. So that's what we did in Camp Roberts. And then you go off to Fort Bliss, Texas to do what's called, mobilization training, right? So you go there, and then you just do nothing but training to deploy in your specific field. Even though that wasn't totally what I did when I deployed, so I feel like that'll come up eventually. Okay. But, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so that was the training to deploy.
And so were you, I mean, how did you feel about being military police? That was something you wanted to do?
Yeah, I guess, again, it was kind of like, they said, we can get you into this now. And I said, all right, let's do that. Because, I mean, you know, when I saw the job options, I had taken the ASVAB, which is the, I forget what ASVAB stands for, but it's the military test to see, like, your, it's like your occupations.
Like
test,
a vocational.
Right? Yeah, it's thing. A vocational test, yeah. And I qualified for everything. So, I mean, I don't know why I picked military police at the time. I think at the time I had thought to myself, well, I think being a cop is kind of cool, right? and why not be one in the military? And it turned out, like, the military police is a great branch. Like, it is awesome. I didn't know it at the time exactly what they did, but it seemed cool. So, cool name.
So you were glad that that's where you ended up?
Oh, 100%. I mean, I'm very proud of the Harpers Ferry, the crossed Harpers Ferry pistols I have on the back of my truck, you know? Like,
that's,
I like
from,
that.
That's the image from that?
Yeah, that's their emblem. Okay. So I guess they're... Yeah, emblem's a word.
Before we continue talking about your deployment.
Sure.
So how did you imagine military life to be before you joined? And how did that change after you actually did join?
That's a good question. Because I didn't join to the active duty sector. I joined to be a reservist, right? But that didn't quite happen. I thought I was going to go to college and just do that, right? Because that was part of their selling, right? But when I joined, I had a friend of mine come up to me and said, hey, you should check out the Honor Guard. So they're the ones that do the military funerals here in San Diego.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, that was a big part of my life. So I had joined thinking I was going to be a reservist, and I had enrolled in college. And then the Honor Guard came to me and they're like, hey, we can hire you. And I said, all right, yeah, let's do that. So I dropped, my day classes, went to night classes. And during the day, I would work with the Honor Guard, and it was super cool. Like, it was a very small group of elite professionals, and it was nothing like I'd expected. I expected, you know, I don't quite know what I had expected, but I had not expected this. And it was a super cool environment. Like, we would go around San Diego just doing funerals all day, and it was humbling. Like, oh, think about a humbling experience. Like, you get put in your place really quick, and you understand exactly your, you know, the group that you become a part of, you know?
And you represent.
Yeah, right? Exactly. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's people that, you know, you get the services that are your, you know, the person that had joined in 1950, you know, and done there a couple of years and got out, right? They get a military service and they're, you know, and it's like the right time to die, you know, like they're old and it's time, right? And that was interesting to see. And when you're 18, that's an interesting thing that you're seeing funerals every single day. And it's not like we just show up and do the service, right? Like sometimes you go first and you get in, get out. But other times you listen to services sometimes 4 or 5 times a day.
Mm-hmm.
And that weighs on your psyche, you know?
It
messes with you. Yeah, like you get as a pastor.
Yes,
it's
say,
a very...
We have
a,
that in common.
Yeah. I'm talking too loud. Oh, dear. We're good? Okay. Pretend like you're not here. Anyway.
So you go to... As a young man, here you are.
So, yeah, as 18, I'm doing this. And I had been picked to go to this group to try it anyway because I was a decent soldier. People... turns out all you have to do is just, like, be better than average and you're somehow amazing. You just have to do your job. And I was selected to go... try out for the Honor Guard, and I tried out, and then in the tryout process, they had these ceremonial bugles that have this, this mic inside of them that you press the button and it'll play taps. But growing up, I was in band and I played trumpet. So here I am, this military policeman showing up, and they don't think I would know anything about music, right? Which mm-hmm. I shouldn't. There's no reason that I would. And the guy had pulled out the tuning slide, and on the tuning slide is what you use to put your instrument in tune, right? He pulled that out, and like this guy did not know how to put it back in. I was like, Sergeant, you're going to break this. May I do it? He's like, what do you know about this? I said, well, I played trumpet for the last decade.
So you didn't join because you played trumpet? That was just a coincidence?
That was just a coincidence.
I thought that's why they recruited you.
No. Yeah, I just wound up doing that. He's like, he's like, no way you can play this. I said, yeah, take out the thing and I'll play that thing right now. And I played it. Didn't sound that great because those instruments are not the nicest. But
it probably wasn't in tune.
No, but I think that day I was going to practice. It was near Christmas time. So I think I was actually going to church that day to practice with Scott Skinner, who's for the record is the music director at our church, mm-hmm. and I was going to practice with him. So the sergeant had said, "Hey, well, you know, if you bring your trumpet by sometime, I was like, I can do you one better. I'm pretty sure it's in my car."
You actually had it with you?
I had it with me because I was going to church right afterwards. So I had it with me. I ran out there, grabbed my trumpet, and brought it out. And he said, "Do you know how to play taps?" And I was like, "I can. It's not that hard. I can figure that out." So we played it for me once, and I just played it back on my trumpet. So we played like the recording. I was like, I can do that, sure. So I played it back on my trumpet, and then like people started coming out of their offices and stuff, and were like, that's so cool. And I was like, okay, well, that just got me in. I ended up playing the trumpet inadvertently. So yeah, people would come up to me and say, are you in the band? I said, no, I'm a military policeman. I just know how to play trumpet.
And I have done several military funerals. Mm-hmm. I did not realize that they weren't actually playing the trumpet all the time, it's a recording.
Very few of them. How interesting. If it's ever Marine Corps, they do it, because the Marine Corps has a band here in San Diego. But yeah, the Army, we have no band here.
Right.
So given you can get access to a trumpet player, then sure. But yeah, if you ever see the ones that are just like a big bugle-looking thing and it's not a trumpet, they're all canned. They do a really good job. Like,
yeah.
I mean, hats off to the military service members who don't know how to play trumpet that can do it just fine, you know? And they make it look good.
Yeah.
Which is the point.
Well, the point is that it's this important moment. And mm-hmm. and I was wondering how you felt about that. I mean, as you have this role for these families who are mourning the loss of a loved one.
Yeah.
I mean, my experience as a pastor is that oftentimes people kind of keep their emotions tapped down a little bit, but then when tap starts playing, they just lose it. Right? I mean, mm-hmm. that's when the tears come. There is something very emotional for families about that.
And that is so hard to trigger.
I was going to say, so what was that like for you, knowing that you had this very important role playing this song for real on the trumpet, not for pretend?
It eats at you because, like, talk about stressful, right? Like, you mess that up, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I just took it, you treat it like every single performance. And if my grandmother could hear this, she would like hit me for saying every single, but she doesn't like that. But yeah, every performance is like it is the only one you're ever going to do. Like, you cannot mess that up. And the honor guard takes that very seriously.
Yeah.
And the moment that you're just doing it to do it is the time when you should probably think about doing something else, you know, because that's not what it's about.
So you wanted to have your heart in it every time.
Yeah, you need to be. It's perfection every single time. And if you don't, there is hell to pay for it, because they have a nice little chat with you if you mess it up. And you know, you're going to mess it up because you stand there for 30 minutes.
Right.
And you just are expected to play. And that, as a musician, that does not happen that well anyway, because I'm not that great at musician. I'm good, not great. So that was cool. And you just close your eyes, you know?
Yeah.
You just don't look at people. But, I mean, sometimes, like, it puts you in your place, you know? It's really a good time to realize what role you're playing in that person's world, you know?
Well, I'm wondering too, here you are, you're a really young guy, mm-hmm, right? And mm-hmm. a lot of 18, 19-year-olds don't have a lot of experience with death or funeral or aging.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, did it cause you to step back and examine some things or think about, like, you know, how you want to live your life? I mean, or have you ask deeper questions like that?
I mean, what it made me do is really detach from death. Like,
oh, interesting.
Like, it's just like, you people die. That's what you like. When my grandfather died, right? I it's like when he died, it was like, oh, okay. He's just like, that's what you do, you know?
Kind of because you had to.
Yeah, because I mean, that's what you got to do. I mean, if you let this eat at you, and not figure out a way to kind of detach yourself from the situation. I mean, you keep it as important and a beautiful moment for the people, but if you get too emotionally invested in it, like, it'll tear you apart. And it made me detach from death and what it's like to lose a loved one, because I saw it every single day, you know? So when I lost my grandfather, when I lost my grandmother, it was just like, okay. You know, it sucks, and there are moments when you miss them, and that's important to embrace. But at the age of 18, it really messes with your dome piece, you know?
Yeah.
Where, you know, it's just kind of like, yep, well, that's what you do, I guess. And it's for the old people, it's different than when you see people that are like the same age as me, you know, because being a live trumpet player, I was a hot commodity, right? Where like it was if there was a killed in action, I was going to be there.
Right.
So they would drive me all around Southern California. Like, I would go from here up to like Northern LA. And that was basically where they would, and then out to the Arizona border, like anywhere in there where there's a killed in action or an active duty death or somebody of extreme importance to the war effort. Right. They would drive me up there and I go play. So like, I saw all of them that happened from 2010 to 2011.
Wow.
Yeah. And that was something, you know, like it's seeing somebody, seeing a funeral for a person who lived a full life of 80 years is one thing. And then seeing somebody who died at 40 from cancer is a whole nother. And then seeing somebody who's 18 who was killed in the war, like that's something. I think it was the first, it must've been the first one that I did. It was the first one I did. And he was from the military police. He was from the 42nd Military Police Brigade. I want to say that, but I feel like that's wrong. Whatever the one with the axe and the, and it's like a, in the patch, there's an axe looking thing. Oh, I can't remember the military police.
It'll
brigade
probably
right
come
now.
To
but
you
yeah,
later,
maybe.
Yeah.
I don't know. There's numbers. It's also been, you know, a decade.
Right.
But yeah. And that was the first killed in action I ever saw. And like that, I think that moment was the moment it sobers you. Like you are, you know, you can think that you're important because, like, being the live bugler, you think you're important, you know, because you're like, oh, everyone thinks I'm awesome, right? But then sometimes you lose sight of the importance of your job, and that was sobering.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, and then so then you were deployed not long after that.
Yeah,
That's an interesting experience to have going into deployment, right? I mean, knowing that you're probably going to see death there, and
that's a whole different thing.
Did it cause you to have second thoughts about being deployed?
No,
all those funerals
that didn't stop me for a second. I mean,
oh, really?
It's just, you know, no, I mean, if you. Statistically, you're more likely to die at home, but you know, but no, that didn't. That was never really a thing. But at the same time, I detached myself from death, so like, dying wasn't a problem. Like if that happened, it happened. You
right.
know,
you had kind of had your mind made up that.
Like, that's just something that happens. I don't
it's
want
part
that.
Of it. Yeah.
Certainly, my mother didn't. You know, it's, it was a Toby Keith song, right? I don't want to die for you, but if Diane's asking me, right? Like, I mean, it's, if it's going to happen, it happens. But anyway.
Well, were you, when it came time for your actual deployment, how did you tell your family, like, what happened?
Oh, I am pretty sure my grandmother was not so happy that I volunteered to deploy. Not convinced if I ever told her I volunteered. I think I just said I'm getting deployed. I don't know if I ever told her that.
This is your mom's mom?
Yeah, my mother's mother, yes. Mm-hmm. My Sandra Jasek, originally Sandra Eastcott. And then before that, Sandra Thompson. Yes, she was married twice.
Mm-hmm.
The second one was the second marriage was the grandfather that I knew. Anyway, back to this. How did I tell them? Yeah, I just told them like we're going, and I think they just knew that I wanted to, you know. And at the time, I had been trying for a while. You know how like when people are trying to get pregnant and people think it's so easy, right? And then it just happens, right? With deployments, people think you just get deployed willy nilly. Oh boy, did I try! Like I went on two different premobilizations. Yeah, I went on. Three different tries to two different mobilizations and only got one of them. So yeah, I volunteered to deploy with the first group that went out. And they were the 756 Transportation Company out of Lancaster, California. And they were going to deploy and they had, I think it was like 45 military policemen they were going to take, and they bring 47 to training because they always lose a couple. right? Because you'll get hurt or something will happen. And they're like, yeah, you'll be in, no worries. And 47 went through and 47 finished. So they're like, all right, man, you're excess. See you later. So I got booted back to the,
Were you disappointed?
Yes. Oh, that's, I was not happy about that. Because it delayed my deployment because I wanted to go, you know? It delayed my deployment to the second group that was going. And then when the second group had me as like extreme excess, I was like, yeah, it's not going to happen. I'm doing that one again because I want to deploy. So I just went to the third group that was going because the way it had been structured is they had the 649th Military Police Company and they were deploying with three platoons of military policemen. Each platoon was going to a company of truckers. So our platoon, I ended up with third platoon and they were deployed with the 1072nd Transportation Company out of Fresno.
Okay.
So that was who I ended up going with. But yeah, so I tried really hard. And I think like my family, like when they heard the first time that I was going to go, like I think they were, you know, rightfully distraught. But like by the end,
worried about
you? Yeah, by the end, they were just like, yeah, it's time to go. All right. so, I mean, I've only ever seen my father cry a couple times and that was one of them, you know? Because growing up, my dad was never a big touchy-feely person, you know? Like, I knew that he loved me, but it was not – emotion was not something he showed. And I think the day I left for basic training was the first time, and the second time was when I left for Afghanistan. And then he's done it a couple more times, but he's breaking down. Yeah, he's getting soft.
But your dad's not military,
no,
right?
He grew up in a military household, but yeah, no, he was never in the military.
That's right.
My mother was, yeah, but not him.
So, okay, so you obviously, and you've talked about this before, you made friends pretty fast with people that you were deployed with.
Yeah.
What did you get to do for fun with your friends when you were deployed?
When we were deployed, oh, okay, so depends. My favorite thing to do is play volleyball because I thought going to Afghanistan, like soccer would be like the big Afghan sport, right? And I feel like they like soccer, but in my region, because I was in the Balkh province, and I don't know if this is true throughout Afghanistan. I can tell you it's true in the Balkh province. They love volleyball. Huh. For some reason, volleyball is a huge thing.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, and we had a ready access to sand, so we had lots of that. So what we do is we'd take this thing called the 10K, and it was this big, like, bulldozer looking thing, right? And we just basically drive that out into a sand dune, fill it up with sand, drive it back on the base, and we dug like this, we had like compressed dirt that we lived on, and then we basically dug like a hole and stuck sand into it, right, and made a volleyball court. And then that got so popular on the base we had to build a second one, so it was super cool. And we had two volleyball courts. And that was sick. Huh. I loved that. So that's what we did. I got really good at volleyball. Really good. I felt
I
like
top. I didn't
know
that. Yeah. You still feel good at volleyball? Are you going to be good for life now?
Yeah, I'm good for life. yeah, there were people that were way better than me. But yeah, I loved that. Oh, it was fun because we had this gazebo that was out there that we built. We go hang out there. That was a thing. And I lived on a COP. So we can explain what that means. So there's a couple different things. Yeah, acronyms, I got that. so there's you have FOBs, which are forward operating bases, right? And they're like the big bases. Like Bagram was a big base. You had, you know, like Kandahar Airfield, you can consider that a FOB, right? Then you had things like the one closest to me was Mazar-e-Sharif or Camp Marmal. That was actually run by the Germans. That was a thing. Big European presence where I was.
Yeah.
And that was the FOB. And then you had COPS, which is Combat Outpost. And I had what's called a JCOP, which is Joint Combat Outpost, which honestly, I don't know the difference. But I'm pretty sure joint just meant the Europeans could be there too or something. I don't know. I know it's called JCOP. That's all I know.
Okay.
The COP is Combat Outpost. And we were out there, and it was super small. Like, we had, like, a company out there, and it was barely that. So like, we had maybe 200 people. Well, no, less than that, because we couldn't man the guard towers all the time. So, like, it was, yeah, very few, very, very, very few people. So that was a thing. You knew everyone on the base. Like, it was a small town kind of a thing, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, everyone knew everyone. And we'd just go hang out, and those who smoked would go and smoke at the gazebo. Somehow, I never touched tobacco. I don't know how I did this, but never touched tobacco.
You never did.
Probably because I knew my father would kill me. I think my mother would maybe be upset with me. My father would kill me. If I did anything. Like, nope. Because, like, he has such an aversion to tobacco in general. He thinks it's, like, the dirtiest substance on earth, I swear to you.
I didn't know that either.
Yeah. Alcohol is fine, but tobacco, God forbid. So I never did that. But I played volleyball, and that was a lot of fun. Other than that, I mean, we had power, so, like, people had, like, gaming systems and stuff that they could play out there, and that was a thing.
So I'm just curious, too. I mean, you grew up going to St. Andrews, the congregation where I served.
I did.
And so your family, and your family's very active there. So
they are now.
Yeah, okay. But church has been a part of your life.
It's been existent.
Existent, okay. But how was your experience in Afghanistan? How did that affect or change or impact your perceptions, like of Muslims, for example? Because here you are in a culture, right, with a totally different faith. Right. And that oftentimes, you know, that's been a huge discussion as people have a lot of ideas about Islam. And so I'm just curious what that was like for you as you got to meet people who are Muslims. And I'm sure that was a new experience for you, right?
Yeah, because there's not so many of them here. Right. There are now.
There are
it's
now.
Been a lot more now, but it was not so existent in 2010 for me. So that's a good question. So, yeah, as far as my faith journey, right, growing up, I was by name a Christian, you know, because that's what we were. Like, on my dog tags said Lutheran churches. But I was not that big into faith. The moment when I knew I believed in God was in Afghanistan, and that's a whole other story. But existing with Muslims, I went there with an open mind. Like, it's a time for you to learn, because there's not another time when you're going to be, you know, rising in the morning when you heard the imam on the loudspeakers doing his call to prayer, right? And I mean, it's interesting because you grow hate through your culture, right? And in the military, there's not always the best light that's shown on Muslims. And that's it's true. And in some reason, there's a lot of reasons why they should think that, but like there's a reason why they do think that, right? Because right. I mean, we've been at war with extremists for the 2 decades, you know, and there's hate there, and I see that, and I get it, and I didn't have it, and I think it bred it in me a little bit, being there and being surrounded by people who have the same, who have that hate, because like I had no reason to dislike them, you know, like I would go and hang out with our interpreters who were very, 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 very Muslim, you know, and I think their religion is cool, and it was really interesting to talk to them about their beliefs, you know. Because, I mean, I just, like, listen to them and just, like, tell me what you think about the Quran, right? And, like, I just realize that it's the Bible 2.0, you know? Like, kind of like the Mormons have their next testament, right? Like, the Quran is just an extra book, you know? Like, I don't see their religion to be separate. I didn't, from my experience, I didn't see their religion to be separate than mine. Just like I don't see Judaism to be separate from mine, right?
Yeah.
It's all the same God. We just look at it through different lenses. Mm-hmm. And it made me grow a ton of respect for people who follow the Islamic faith. Like, I would not do well in Ramadan. I can do Lent.
Yeah.
And theirs is like Lent on steroids.
That much of us, yeah.
Yeah. So like, oh man, Ramadan was the most interesting time for me.
I bet.
Mm-hmm. That was cool. But yeah, I mean, what it did is it gave me perspectives. Like, I could say now, like, I know what they're about, you know, like I spend enough time with them intimately, you know, on a day-to-day basis that I know what they think, and it made me respect it as a religion. Like, it's just like, okay, cool, like I could, like, their faith, it is there, you know. And
so now you're in the midst of transitioning back kind of into civilian life.
Yeah.
You've made the decision that you're not going to be in the reserves anymore,
no,
right? That you're
I'm
done
out.
With
ETS,
the National Guard.
I got out, a month and 13 days ago? So
So what has that been like for you? I know it was a big decision.
Yeah, that was rough. But yeah, I mean, it worked out great, because like right now at the time of this interview, I'm working over at SPAWAR, which is one of the local research labs. I mean, I'm getting my master's in applied mathematics and I already have a bachelor's, you know, like why mess up that role? And I mean, I'll still be getting to help out the warfighter, you know, just from a different angle.
Yeah.
And I think it's time for that. And transitioning now, I mean, maybe it comes from my time in disassociation with the world around me that I learned from being in the Honor Guard. But getting out, this is kind of like, okay, we're just like, this is where you are now.
You're just
moving
on.
Like, it's moving forward. And
it wasn't like a big dramatic thing for you.
Oh, gosh, you know, identity-wise, yeah, we talked about that, right? Because like I've had Sergeant in front of my name for the last couple of years. You know, I've had a Specialist and Private before that. And it was weird not having that, and it is still weird not having that. Like, that's been kind of weird, but like, and we had talked about it, so you lose your identity. But like, the way I see it, I mean, it's something that you're not moving on, you're just moving forward, you know?
Yeah.
Like, it is a piece of me, and it will always be a piece of me, and I am so blessed to have that in my life. But I mean, I'm lucky because I have such a great family and I have such a great community around me that my military is my only identity, and I think that's what I kind of had to come up with. And I came up with it you know, I guess now, that the military isn't my only identity. Sergeant Ferrante is a great guy, and he did some cool things. But, you know, Nick the mathematician is rising, and Nick the family man hopefully will be within the next couple years, God willing. So, yeah. So it's just a new title, you know? It's a not moving on, moving forward. So.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah, and so part of that, too, is you're in a relationship with Han.
I am, so I guess she gets to be in this. She's got to stick around.
I wanted to make sure we talked about Han. And like you said, she's from Vietnam, right? And so what's that like, spending time with her, meeting her family? You are obviously not Vietnamese.
No, very not. yeah, I'm very white. Yeah, so, I mean, I knew nothing about Vietnamese culture. I'd had pho a couple times, so that was about it. And we met as mathematicians. She got her degree in chemistry, and she's getting her doctorate right now in pharmaceutical science. So she'll be Dr. Dan in May. And she's the love of my life. And I hit a home run. Like this is a grand slam. I could not ask for a better partner. She's so awesome. And it's interesting being around people that are not like me at all.
Yeah.
I mean, Han is a lot like me. To like a scary degree, but like her mother and her father are just sweet people that are just loving people, and it doesn't matter the color of your skin or the words that come out of your mouth, a good person is a good person, you know. And they embody that,
and so they're supportive of your guys's relationship
from what I can tell. Mama Ha likes me and Papa Ope likes me, so you know, things are good so far.
Yeah and obviously you have in common your careers, right? That's where you met, studying math. What made you choose math?
I was good at it. like, that was literally it.
Were you always good at it?
I think so. People tell me I was. I don't see myself as good at it. I think I just saw myself as I could do it. But when I got to college, I was like, I guess I'll be a math major. Why not? And I was originally a mathematics education major, and my Uncle Bill, who's an engineer, talked me out of it. And he said, no. All right, yeah, math education is good, but, like, you should get a quote real degree, you know, like instead of having an education degree, like go get
an
applied math degree. And then if you want to go teach math, go teach math, you know, like at least you tried, you know? So I was like, sure, why not? And then the next thing I know, I'm working for Dr. Jerome Gilles so he's in this too. Good for him. he's working for him as an image processor. He used to work for the French Ministry of Defense. And so his interests are in the same wheelhouse is mine, and I do image processing for the detection of targets, so helping out the warfighter. And so that was the best move I ever made, is going into academia. Oof, that's good. But yeah.
Okay. Well, gosh. Okay. Well, I'm trying to think if there's any other stuff. We covered a lot. I feel like we've only been around the bases.
I know.
Ugh. We have a lot of really great stories.
We're so fortunate, right?
Yeah.
Well,
I mean, is there anything else you felt like you wanted to share that we didn't get a chance to cover in our last minute?
I just want to say to the people listening to this in the future, hello. To my family that maybe will find this, hello.
No, we're going to get to share it with them.
Well, right, but I'm talking about like how long after I'm dead. Like, like this isn't going anywhere. So hello, my spawn. It is, I'm glad, I hope you're doing well. I mean, but that aside, I mean, I'm just so happy that I get to have such a great life, and I'm so blessed and I'm so fortunate to be in such a great country, in such a great part of the world. I love San Diego. I ain't ever leaving. I'm just a blessed man, and I want to thank Pastor Sarah for bringing this up to me.
Yeah. Thank you. I'm really glad we could make it happen.
Me too.
It was really fun.
Yes, ma'am.
All right, and I think you have a lot more stories I want to hear.
Oh, yes. we'll go to West Coast Barbecue and get beer. I don't know if in the future craft beer is going to be still a thing. I hope so. San Diego has good craft beer, and we're going to drink that.
All right, we'll do that. Okay.